You'll see me again on Monday. I'm going to talk about my research for 15 minutes if you're interested. And then you won't see me again unless you come talk to me. So I'm really lonely in my office. If you guys ever want to come say hi, talk about science, I'm there. Okay, so any questions about what we talked about yesterday? Okay, so we'll just briefly recap what we did yesterday. So we talked about special relativity. Okay, and I guess here the catchphrase would be physics is the same in all inertial frames. And we wrote down the line elements, delta S squared, and so that's related to this guy here. The metric in flat space, eta mu nu. And we could write this in, you know, we could choose to write this in some matrix notation, which is convenient. And in that matrix notation, eta is just -1 with ones on the diagonal. And I don't know why I wrote delta t. Delta x is a vector with element c, delta t, delta x, delta y, delta z, where the delta refers to the distance between two events, right? So so it's always important to anchor yourself on events. And so we know what this means. Okay, so this delta refers to two events. And this guy here, delta S squared, so this is invariant under Lorentz transformations. Of course, Lorentz transformations are the things that take you between inertial frames, and so that means that the space-time element is preserved in any inertial frame between two events. Doesn't matter what frame I'm in, I'll always get the same answer. Okay, so that sums up space-time in special relativity. And then we generalize that, so to get to general relativity, the catchphrase here is physics is the same in any coordinate system. Okay, so we go from Lorentz transformations to diffeomorphisms, and we promote this metric tensor, this metric, which, you know, here it secretly is a tensor, but we didn't have to use the concept of tensors. We promote it to a tensor, where basically then, by definition, we're guaranteed that things are preserved in any coordinate system. So so we've got ds squared is g mu nu, dx mu, dx nu. This is a tensor. Ds squared would be the same thing as writing like g, right? Where these things here would be, these would be the elements of the metric tensor, and these things here would be the basis elements. So this is a 0-2 tensor, and so I need to tack on the basis elements for my 0-2 tensor. And then this is an honest-to-God tensor. And tensor is always invariant under coordinate transformations or diffeomorphisms. So ds squared, just draw an arrow, this thing is invariant under diffeomorphism, or for short, diffs. And if you recall, the way that we implement a diffeomorphism is using the tensor transformation law. So for example, for the metric tensor, we would write dx mu, dx mu prime, dx nu prime, g mu nu, okay, where literally, if I knew x mu as a function of the new coordinates, x mu prime, I just evaluate these derivatives. So basically then it's matrix multiplication, and that's how I would do this coordinate transformation. Okay. So that's how we implement diffeomorphisms. So that's geometry, but I still haven't told you how this has anything to do with gravity. So that's basically the goal of today, is to talk about how the metric tensor is something that, in fact, can describe gravitational forces on objects. And this is the metric tensor is sort of the central element in Einstein's theory of gravity. So let's do that. So why don't we just start by remembering gravity a la Newton? Okay, so if I've got some coordinate system, this isn't space-time, this is just space. So z, x, y. If I put some mass here, and I put some point mass, and we'll give it mg, where the subscript g reminds me that this is the mass that goes into Newton's law, and we'll make a distinction about that in a second. If there's some vector r between my point mass at the center here and this probe mass, mg, then the force between these two objects would be g Newton times big M times little mg over the magnitude of that vector r squared in the direction of that vector. And so that's the gravitational force. And of course, we can write this as a gravitational potential. Depending on your convention, I think I used a different convention last time where I absorbed m into phi, but I could also define it this way. Let's define it this way for today. So this can also be expressed as the gradient of a scalar. So that's the gravitational potential, phi. And we also know that F equals ma, okay, where now, if we're going to be super anal, we should make a distinction. So this is really the inertial mass, okay? So this is going to be the, impediment to moving an object. And there's no real reason a priori for mi to equal mg. So that's something we could test, like experimentally, right? We could ask, is it really true that the inertial mass equals the gravitational mass for all objects? And you can go up to the Leaning Tower of Pisa and drop, a bowling ball and a feather and test whether or not that's really true. And you find that indeed it is really true. So this is an empirical fact. The fact that the inertial mass equals the gravitational mass, in a sense, for Newton, is an empirical fact about our universe. Now, of course, it's more than that if we go beyond Newton. Right, so the fact that the inertial and the gravitational masses are equal is sort of central. It's like the assumption that the speed of light is constant in all inertial frames. It's the equivalent of that for general relativity, and it's called the equivalence principle. Okay, so the fact that mi equals mg in gr is known as the equivalence principle. Okay. In fact, there are different versions of the equivalence principle. This one would be the weak equivalence principle, if we want to be more specific. Okay, and we can state this in a slightly different way, which is to say that in general, in a small enough region of space-time, the motion of freely falling particles is the same in a uniform gravitational field, or a uniformly accelerating frame. And that's basically another way of stating that the inertial and the gravitational masses are the same. So if I set this force equal to this force and mi equals mg, then there should be no real way of distinguishing for different particles between just being accelerated and being in the presence of a uniform gravitational field. Now, of course, you can falsify it. And the way you could falsify this, the legalese way to falsify this is to note that here we say in a small enough region of space-time. So if I'm sitting outside of this big mass and I'm doing an experiment where I'd say I have two masses, then I know that these two masses are going to be falling into this object on slightly different vectors, and so there would be a way of telling that I'm actually around a mass and not just uniformly accelerating, right? Because I'd see that these objects are actually, they actually have some component of a velocity vector acceleration towards each other.
So yeah. In this description, you always say angular acceleration, you just ignore that, right? Because we're just talking about radial acceleration. So is there anything that we can impose on the radial velocity, angular velocities?
Yeah. You mean, is there an example where we could apply the equivalence principle in a... Oh, this is totally general. So there's no assumption in here about talking about radial forces versus not radial forces. So this is completely general. It could apply to other things like centrifugal force, for example. So if I have a spinning object, I can ask, is there a difference between a gravitational field and an acceleration field because, I'm stuck to a wheel.
Yeah. But there is no equivalence principle for the moment of inertia, for example. Right? It's a different kind of mass that we know.
Sure. So here again, I think the important part of the statement is a uniformly accelerating frame. And so if I have some complicated inertial tensor, then that means that they're going to be the equivalent of like tidal forces. So I will be able to tell the difference between, some uniform force, which is what I'd get in a uniformly accelerating frame, and this particular situation, whatever's going on in that particular situation. So that I think would fall under, if I could really, and this is a bad example because I guess, I don't know, in this case, we're talking about some extended object and it has some, properties. But if I were to zoom in on an infinitesimal piece of that object, then I think this would be fine. I think then you really would just, be experiencing some set of forces that I could encapsulate as, locally a constant acceleration. But also, I guess in that case, if I had to pick that apart even more, you probably violate that in your solid because my piece here is stuck to the piece next to it. So it wouldn't really be a freely falling particle. So yeah, you're right. There's sort of a realm of validity of this statement. And if I have a solid, probably I would be outside of that realm of validity. Yeah. Unless the solid was really, really tiny compared to the mass that I have. Yeah. Okay. So we can actually get a lot of mileage out of this statement. This is it seems benign and like self-evident, but you can get an incredible amount of information about physics from this statement. So, for example, if I can solve a problem in a small enough region of space-time, then I can pretty much solve it everywhere. If I can solve a problem for a uniform acceleration, then I can get information about gravity. So let's do that. Let's solve a problem involving, I guess I'm on the backboard now. Let's solve a problem using uniform acceleration and see what this has to do with gravity. So consider a free particle. Hey guys, it's a little bit distracting for you to talk. I mean, you're welcome to talk if you want to go outside. That's totally up to you, but it's distracting. I think it's distracting for others too. So consider a free particle. So in Newton, it's going to move according to F equals zero. So, well, first of all, the velocity is zero, so dy dt equals zero. And furthermore, of course, d squared y dt squared is zero. Okay, so if it's a free particle, my notes are terrible. The twos got erased selectively. So forget about, I don't know why I wrote this, that's stupid. If it's freely moving, it can be moving at any constant velocity. Zero is not special, just zero acceleration. So now what we can do is we can transform to a uniformly accelerating frame. So that we could just define as the trajectory of some uniformly accelerated particle. So x minus 1/2 at squared, for example. Okay, so now we can just plug this in, so we can start taking derivatives. So so dy dt is just going to be dx dt minus a times t, and then we could take the second derivative, d squared y dt squared. That's d squared x dt squared minus a. Okay, so if that equals zero, as we said before, then in this new frame, it follows that there's a force. Okay, so kind of obviously, I guess, but in a uniformly accelerating frame, we have a particle now that experiences a force in Newton's laws. So now let's just do the same thing, but let's do it in special relativity. So let's do this for the relativistic version of Newton's second law. Okay, so in special relativity, we have, again, the line element. And actually, now I'm going to promote those deltas to d's in anticipation of what comes next. Okay, so that's the Minkowski. Okay, so flat space, empty space, Minkowski space, all the same thing. This is just negative 1, 1, 1, 1. So that's that. And if we consider a path through space-time, and we evaluate the sort of elapsed interval on a small segment of this path, we can define something called the proper time. And that's just negative ds squared. Okay. So just stick a negative sign out front. So if I integrate this along said path, then I would just get the elapsed watch time of an observer that was following that line. Okay, so now what we can do is we can write down Newton's laws. So we'll write that here. So d squared y rho d tau squared is zero. Okay, so just the four velocity instead of the velocity goes in here. So there's a four acceleration based on the four position four vector. And now we can go again to an arbitrary frame. Which is described by coordinates x mu. Okay, so now again I have both a space and a time in there. And let's say that I know y rho as a function of these new coordinates. So I know there's some coordinate transformation, I know it, and let's just take it for granted that I know it. So now I can just start taking derivatives. So the first thing we can do is use the chain rule. So we've got dy rho d tau for the first derivative, and that could be the partial derivative of y rho with respect to x mu times the derivative of x mu with respect to the proper time. Or equivalently, the chain rule you can see is the same thing as the tensor transformation law for this four velocity. So really that's all I've done is applied the tensor transformation law to this four velocity. And now we can take the second derivative. Okay, so the second derivative, now things are going to get a little bit more complicated because I have to apply it to both of these guys. So the first term we can apply it to the derivative with respect to proper time. So we'll get d squared x mu d tau squared. And then I'll get another term that is a sort of second derivative of this coordinate transformation. So we'll get d squared y rho dx mu dx nu. And now that guy is going to act on dx mu d tau dx nu. Okay, so we've got this piece, which was the piece we started with, and now we've got that one there. And so we can now just take this, and this, of course, equals zero. And we can perform an inversion. So if I flip this over, that's like the same thing as the inverse coordinate transformation. So if I were to do a coordinate transformation from x to rho, okay, so from here, it follows that d squared x d tau, and we'll put an index up here. We'll put a different index just for fun. And then in here we've got dx lambda dy rho d squared y rho dx mu dx nu dx mu d tau dx nu d tau. So you can see we picked up, just as we did in the Newtonian example, a force, right? So now the thing that we call our acceleration force is this thing on the right-hand side, sorry? Am I missing a plus sign? No, I don't think so. So I've set this guy to zero, and I just stuck this on the other side, and then I perform the inverse coordinate transformation here and brought it over to the right-hand side. So that should be good. Okay, so I have this acceleration-based force. And now we can ask, well, we can answer our question, what does geometry now have to do with gravity? So if I go to this new coordinate frame, ds squared, so I know I'm going to assert that these things are now honest to God tensors, and so they're diff invariant. And so I can write this using again the tensor transformation law as dy rho dx mu dy sigma dx nu, acting on dx mu dx nu. Okay, so all I've done is just applied the tensor transformation law to go from these coordinates y to these coordinates x. Okay. And now I'm just going to call this thing g mu nu. I'm going to assert that this is now the metric. So it's built out of this regular Minkowski space metric, just the minus 1, 1, 1, 1, and this coordinate, this arbitrary coordinate transformation. Okay. And that's a metric. And in fact, I claim you can go from Minkowski space to any metric you want using a local coordinate transformation. That is a restatement of this. So in a local frame, everything looks like flat. So I can just screw around with flat space, and then you know, that sort of generalizes everything. Okay, so this X observer, he sort of is living, the observer living in this frame defined by the coordinates X is in fact living in a curved space-time in general. So this, you know, there's some, and we'll talk about what curvature means in a second, I guess, but just to throw a term out there, that's curvature in a sense. And now we can define a quantity. Okay, so we're going to define something. We're going to define something called the Christoffel connection. This is not a tensor, although it has indices. It's just an object. Okay, so it doesn't obey the tensor transformation law, but it's just an object. And this object is going to be basically defined as the thing that's sitting out in front on the right-hand side of our force law. Okay, so this Christoffel connection is just the thing, it's the object that I have to multiply this dx mu d tau, dx nu d tau to get my acceleration. And if we use this definition for the metric, we can rewrite this as derivatives of the metric. So this is, you know, maybe a page of algebra, but you can show this for yourself as an exercise. Chalk. So this is g lambda rho d mu g nu rho plus d nu g rho mu minus d rho g mu nu. Okay, where I've done a few things that you don't know yet, but might as well do it now. So this is shorthand for partial x mu, and you'll see that often. Can interchange these different notations. You know, sometimes this thing you could also see as g nu rho comma mu. That also means the same thing. So there are many ways to write partial derivatives. I'm sure every lecturer will use a different way of writing these partial derivatives, so I guess you might as well get to know them now. Second thing I've done, you can see some of the indices are upstairs and some of the indices are downstairs. So g mu nu is the metric, but g upper mu nu is the inverse metric. And if I think about matrices, g inverse would have components g mu nu, d mu, d nu. Okay? So in matrices, this guy, it's like the inverse of the metric. So for something like the negative 1, 1, 1, 1, nothing happens. The inverse is equal to itself. And that's why in special relativity, you never worry about upstairs, downstairs, because it doesn't do anything, really. But in general here, you got to worry about it. OK, so with this definition, then we can write down something that you will see in GR. And that something is called the geodesic equation. And this is the path. This tells you the path that particles follow in a curved space. Okay. So you can see we've kind of shown what we wanted to show now. There is a direct link between forces, experiences by particles in a uniformly accelerating frame, and geometry. And then by the equivalence principle, that means that gravity can be described as geometry. So this equivalence principle plus this derivation, you know, basically tells you that I can totally exchange gravitational forces for geometry. It's one-to-one. Okay. This is the fastest way I know of to get to GR. But you will take the slow route with many more technical details in the courses. But you know, if you like, this is totally fine. This is a totally kosher derivation of the equivalence between geometry and gravity. So feel free to use it too. That's totally fine. Okay, so I guess here, this we'll write down that down on the board for hyperbole. The geodesic equation plus the equivalence principle implies that gravity and geometry can be interchanged. And that's sort of the key insight of general relativity. So at least in this derivation, you can see how important this was, the equivalence principle. And that's really how I bridged the gap between a uniformly accelerating frame and geometry. So that is key. The equivalence principle is absolutely key. All right, so from that, I guess we've sort of seen this equivalence, and we've seen that g mu nu, this metric tensor, is sort of a central player, because g mu nu is what determined my pseudo force, if you will, or my gravitational force, the thing that we end up calling the gravitational force. So g mu nu is really a central player. So g mu nu more or less tells particles how to move. By the way, a geodesic is sort of generalization of the shortest path between two lines or two points in a curved space. That's what we mean by a geodesic. Okay. And by shortest, I mean the shortest space-time interval. Okay, so it could be either something that propagates in time for the shortest proper time, or like in space. Okay, good. So what do we mean by curvature? So curvature is defined by something called the Riemann tensor. Okay, and the Riemann tensor tells us something about what happens to vectors on closed paths as you go along a manifold. So to give you an example of something that's not curved, let's just take this piece of the board, two-dimensional board, right? So I can take a vector pointing in this direction, and I can move it to here, and then I can move it to here, and move it to here, and move it back, and when I get back to where I started, I have the same vector. Okay, it's pointing in the same direction. So that's one way of characterizing the absence of curvature. This is so-called parallel propagation. And parallel propagation is basically defined by the geodesic equation, where I just specify the path for you. So this is going to tell me how vectors change in direction as I go along a closed path. And the Christoffel connection, if you will, is sort of the device that tells me how vectors change as I move along a path. Okay, so that's no curvature. Now, a case where there certainly is curvature would be a manifold that is closed, so like the surface of a two-dimensional sphere. So forget about the existence of the inside and the outside of the sphere. The whole world is just the surface of the sphere, and I'm only allowed to move along the surface. So now if I take a vector, and let's say I propagate it here along the equator, and then I take it up to the North Pole, and then I take it back down to the equator, I will not get the same vector. So if I parallel propagate this vector along the sphere, it tilts as I go up to the top, and then when I bring it down, it's not pointed in the same direction. And so the fact that these two vectors don't line up when they come back tells me that this is curved. So here in this case, curvature, check. And there's a tensor that tells me that that's the Riemann tensor. So there's a tensor that tells me that quantifies this curvature. It basically quantifies the degree to which vectors going around a closed path do not come back to themselves. And the Riemann tensor is a four-index object. You can understand that as basically having to do with the fact that I could express a closed path as this sort of like polygon. There's a name for it. What is it? Parallelopiped or something? Anyway, there's some name for that. Yeah, something like that. Just some closed path made of with four sides. Okay. Anyway, there's four indices having to do with sort of four infinitesimal changes here. So the Riemann tensor is what happens when you shrink this sort of down in size. Okay, so here this is defined basically as derivatives of the Christoffel connection. Plus contractions of the Christoffel connection squared. Okay, I think I got all my contractions right. So this is the Riemann tensor. It has to do with derivatives and contractions of the Christoffel connection. Now these things here, you can think in spirit. These are like second derivatives of G. Okay, so these are like second derivatives of the metric because the Christoffel connection itself is built of first derivatives of the metric. And how do I usually classify curvature? It's usually with a second derivative, right? So in some sort of very qualitative sense, the Riemann tensor is telling you it's like some matrix of second derivatives of the metric. Sort of roughly speaking. That's not exactly right, but heuristically that's okay to think. If I were to quantify what is the curvature at the top of a hill, I would take some matrix of second derivatives and that would tell me the curvature. So this is kind of in spirit doing that. So that's a tensor, and then I can build other tensors by contracting different numbers of these indices. So there's something called the Ricci tensor. So the Ricci tensor is a rank 0,2 tensor, and that's got that's built basically by contracting the first and the third index of the Riemann tensor. And then there is a scalar quantity that I can make. So I can make the Ricci scalar. And the Ricci scalar is basically, I now just want to contract the Ricci tensor. Okay. I guess I haven't explained this, but what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is I would act the inverse metric g mu nu on r mu nu. And that's the same thing as what I've written here. So g mu nu is the quantity that raises and lowers indices. I guess I hadn't mentioned that. Okay, so this is how we quantify curvature mathematically. And now, given that, we can ask, we can write down Einstein's equation. So this is the part where, if you like, by analogy, the geodesic equation is, I guess I erased the picture. So in this picture of a big point mass m and a little point mass mg, the geodesic equation tells me how this guy moves, right? And the thing that tells me how this thing gravitates, well, that thing is Einstein's equation. Okay, so Einstein's equation is the thing that tells me how a mass sources curvature, or how a mass sources a gravitational force. The geodesic equation is the thing that tells me, if I already know the force, how does the thing move? Okay, so so what is that? So Einstein's equation is built from curvatures. So it's the Ricci tensor minus 1/2 times the metric times the Ricci scalar. And then there's another term in here we can add, which is a so-called cosmological constant. And this thing is equal to 8 pi times g newton times the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so the energy momentum tensor is the thing that contains information about the matter. So this would be the thing that tells me about that point mass. If it was a point mass, then T mu nu would just be proportional to m times a delta function at some point. Okay. So this would be the thing that tells me about the stuff. And then on the left-hand side, we've got all these things that have to do with the curvature. So Einstein's equation is the thing that tells me, given a source of stress energy, how does the universe curve? There's Wheeler's, you know, favorite summing up of the Einstein's equation, which is, matter tells space how to curve, and then space tells matter how to move. So that's the summary of Einstein's equation plus the geodesic equation. So what is Einstein's equation really? Let's start to think about it. So g mu nu, the metric, well, first of all, you can think this is like a second order partial differential equation for g mu nu given t mu nu. I guess as a corollary, we need to tell you what the dynamics of T mu nu are. So T mu nu is defined, the dynamics of T mu nu are defined by this equation, sort of like a conservation equation. It is the generalization of conservation of energy and momentum. So Einstein's equations is a set of second order partial differential equations for G mu nu given T mu nu. And if you like, Einstein's equation plus this conservation equation is a closed system, right? So then I can know the dynamics of both curvature and matter. So how many PDEs are there? So let's dig into that. So the metric has the metric is symmetric. Why is it symmetric? Because I don't think there's any difference between we don't distinguish between between dx dy and dy dx. So if you like, space-time is commutative. Why don't I put it that way? Okay. Of course, if you're a quantum gravity enthusiast, you'd be like, no, non-commutative space-time. But anyway, for GR, that's fine. Okay, so g mu nu is symmetric. If we write it in matrix form, this is a 4x4 matrix. Okay, so let's count how many components are there. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 1. And everything over here has to be the mirror if it's symmetric. So that's 4 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1 equals 10. Okay. So in GMU-NU, there are 10 components because it's a 4x4 symmetric matrix. But here we can we've got four coordinate choices. So actually, we subtract those off. So that would give us six independent components. So real dynamical components, there's six. So I've got 10, but then I could do a coordinate transformation. I could get rid of any four of those I want. And so really, I just have six. Or I could come up with four relations between things, so they're not really independent. So really, there's just six independent components. So that means that Einstein's equation is really six independent partial differential equations for the different components of the metric. That's hard. So, you know, solving one PDE is really hard. Solving six independent PDEs is really, really hard. And so that's why we don't know how to classify, for example, all the solutions to Einstein's equations. The way you solve Einstein's equations is you make a guess, and then you check if it's right. Or if you're really hardy and you like computers, then there are classes of solutions that you can solve for on a computer by trying to solve these six PDEs. There's a lot more to Einstein's equations than this, but you know that's the cartoon version for today. Sure. So if I just had any old metric and I just require it to be symmetric, then there's going to be 10 components because it's 4x4 symmetric. But that's an arbitrary, I sort of haven't made any choices of a coordinate system yet. Okay. So this is a tensor. It's independent of a coordinate system. But let's say I specialized. So I picked a basis and I wrote down some coordinate basis. Then what I would find is it's always possible to choose a coordinate basis where I only have six components. And that amounts to the fact that I can perform just coordinate redefinitions you know, in a restricted sense, because you know I have to pick four coordinates at the end of the day. But once I pick those four coordinates, I can always eliminate four components. Or I can write down four constraints between the different components. And that basically is what a coordinate choice is, if you like. It's a set of constraints on these components. Some are zero, or maybe some are related in some way. Does that answer your question? Okay. Okie dokie. I guess I'll move over here now. So the last half hour, I guess I'd just like to talk about some of the solutions to Einstein's equation, some of the metrics, the ones that you'll probably meet the most often, and teach you a little bit about the art of interpreting a metric physically. Okay, so the key to this guess and check approach of solving Einstein's equation is basically to assume symmetries. So just like solving Maxwell's equations, if you assume symmetry, then you can find solutions, because now with symmetry, you can reduce your six independent partial differential equations into, for example, one ordinary differential equation. And I can solve one ordinary differential equation. That's human scale ability, not superhuman scale ability. So symmetries are very helpful. That's basically the key. So I'll just write that down. So let's think about the most symmetric thing possible. Completely empty space. Completely empty space is invariant under rotations. It's invariant under translations. It's invariant under Lorentz boosts. So, you know, We can mix up space and time. It's the most symmetric thing. Okay, and I told you that it had so for Minkowski space, that's the same thing as flat space. So here there's three rotational symmetries, three boosts, and four translations. So that gives us 10. So there's sort of 10 different types of symmetry that empty flat space has, and that's the max in four dimensions. And it's really powerful because I have 10 symmetries, and I have 10 components of my metric. Okay, so that means I have as many symmetries as I have independent components of the metric, which means I don't have to solve any equations. I can just write down the answer. So this is with 10 symmetries. This is something called maximal symmetry, so or maximally symmetric. This is the cartoon version. With each of these 10 things, I can associate a vector called a killing vector, and so on and so forth. And killing vectors are the things in that define symmetries in sort of a tensorial way. But cartoon version, that's fine. Okay. So in Minkowski space, of course, we know what the metric is. So it's negative dt squared plus dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. I can also write this. Oh, and by the way, here and henceforward, I will probably set c to 1. So instead of putting a c squared, there's no c squared. Get used to it. I'm sure like people will just randomly forget to put c's and h bars and c's and g's and all these things. So of course, I could do a coordinate transformation and still get flat space. There's the metric for flat space in spherical coordinates. We could write the metric for flat space in cylindrical coordinates. And you know, pick your favorite metric for flat space. So how would I know? How would I know that these all are really flat space? I would shove these things into my Riemann tensor. Okay, and if I get zero, then I know it's flat space. So if all the elements of the Riemann tensor are zero, then I know this is sort of got to be Minkowski space. Okay, and how would I go between these different metrics? Well, I would just write down what x, y, z are in terms of the spherical coordinates and apply my tensor transformation law. So actually, I encourage you to, as an exercise, see if you can do that. So that's how I would perform a coordinate transformation to get between these different versions of Minkowski space. So as it turns out, there are other maximally symmetric spaces. And you know, if you like a physical way of thinking about a maximally symmetric space is to think that it's something that is the same at every position in space and at every position in time. So it's completely homogeneous in space and time, isotropic in space and time, and therefore, you know, I can't do anything to make it different. I guess that's the definition. I can't do anything to make it different. So it's everywhere the same. And now another thing that is everywhere the same is a space-time that has only a cosmological constant. Okay, so these space-times are known as de Sitter. That's if the cosmological constant is bigger than zero, or the evil version, anti-de Sitter, that wears a funny mustache and he's got lambda less than 0. Okay, so those are the other two things that I can have that are also maximally symmetric. Why are they maximally symmetric? Because this is a constant. Okay, so lambda is a constant. So there's no thing that breaks translation invariance or rotational invariance or boost invariance. It's always the same. And the metric for De Sitter or anti-De Sitter looks a little bit more complicated. So now I've got 1 minus lambda over 3 r squared. I'll write it in spherically symmetric coordinates. Okay, so this is what the metric looks like in De Sitter or anti-De Sitter. So you'll notice one thing kind of funny happens. So in De Sitter, if lambda is bigger than 0, then this thing right here goes to infinity at r equals square root 3 over lambda. That seems alarming. And so this fact that the coefficient of dr squared is going to infinity could mean one of two things. It could mean that there is a so-called curvature singularity. Okay, and if it's a curvature singularity, that means that the Riemann tensor, some elements of the Riemann tensor, will also go to infinity. Okay. So if I plug this metric in and I find that that's true as r goes to root 3 over lambda, then in fact gr breaks and I don't know what to do. Okay. And sort of I'm cooked. But in this case, if you do that, what you'll find is that this is something that's known as a coordinate singularity. And that means that if I evaluate the Riemann tensor, I'll find that all of the elements are finite. So that's not a dangerous thing. What it means is I basically chosen a choice of coordinates that just stop working at some point. Okay. But nothing really eventful happens there. In fact, in this case, what I found is something that's associated oftentimes with a coordinate singularity. And that is an event horizon. So in a De Sitter space, if I stray too far from the origin, so if here is some fiducial origin of coordinates, and I stray too far, there's this spherical surface. And if I go outside of the spherical surface, I can never come back. That's the meaning of an event horizon. It separates things like causally. So once you leave, you can try and come back, but you will never ever come back to where you started from. I'm sure you all are familiar with event horizons in black holes. De Sitter space is like an inside-out black hole. They usually think if you fall into a black hole, you can never come out. In De Sitter space, if you stray too far away from a point, you can never come back. So it's like, there is this no return. Okay, so that's two solutions. Those are the maximally symmetric solutions to Einstein's equation. And we could write down now solutions that have less symmetry. So now I'm just left with choices that are going to have less symmetry than that. Those are the only choices with maximal symmetry. So the next easiest thing I can do is I can write down solutions that break translation invariance in space but retain spherical symmetry. And these would be the Schwarzschild solutions. So here we're going to still have, basically, we just have spherical symmetry. Plus time translations, and that's it. So no more boost symmetries, no more translation symmetries. And so here there's a lot less, right? So here we've only got four. So I'm not going to be able to use this trick where I can just know instantaneously what the metric looks like by constraints. Now I actually have to solve equations. And fortunately for us, there is a theorem called Birkhoff's theorem that tells us exactly how to write down the metric that is spherically symmetric and has time translation invariance. Okay, and so you can more or less uniquely cast it in terms of two independent metric functions that end up being related. And of course, this is just a black hole, which I'm sure you've all seen the solution for. So this is 2gm over r dt squared plus 1 minus 2gm over r inverse dr squared plus r squared d theta squared sine squared theta d phi squared. And again, we have this this funny thing happening that at r equals 2gm, this goes to infinity. But that again is just a coordinate singularity. There's an inside of the black hole, and when I cross that, I cross the event horizon. There's nothing funny that happens there. It's just where the coordinates break down. Okay, so that's when I basically broke some of these spatial symmetries, and I can now write down solutions where we break. We break time translations. Okay, so these are going to be the Friedman, Robertson, Walker space-time, sometimes called FRW, and sometimes Lemaître gets in there, and it's called FLRW, and sometimes Friedman is left off, and it's just RW. So I don't know, people are confused about who gets the credit. I don't have an opinion, but I'll call it FRW. So these are solutions that here we now break. Well, we'll write down the symmetries we keep because that's been my trend. So here we're going to keep rotations and spatial translations. And we're going to ditch the boosts and we're going to ditch the time translations. Okay, so these metrics will be different at different points in time. And then therefore I can't do boosts anymore because I can't mix up space and time because it's different in time. So here we just have rotations and spatial translations. And this, of course, is the metric of cosmology. Okay, you'll remember this. That's the scale factor. We talked about that earlier. Okay, so this is a universe that is completely homogeneous in space. This looks like the same. This is the same piece of the Minkowski metric. It just gets multiplied by a time-dependent function. Okay, so this is, of course, these are cosmological spacetimes. Incidentally, so are these. These are also cosmological spacetimes. I can write them in a way that looks like this, but secretly they have more symmetries. In fact, our universe is now tending towards De Sitter, we think. So that's a particularly relevant metric. If you are a string theory enthusiast, you will learn all about anti-de Sitter, because we have a theory of quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter and no other spacetime. Okay, so that's just kind of a laundry list, I guess, of the types of the most important metrics. Okay, so if we're going to understand anything, we should understand these ones. These are the most symmetric spacetimes that we can have. And then as you get less and less symmetric, it becomes harder and harder to solve Einstein's equations. So now, you know, the thing I've showed you is the spacetimes, right? So here we need some energy momentum. So for the maximally symmetric ones, the energy momentum tensor is zero. For this one, T mu nu is going to have some point mass. For this one, T mu nu has got to contain some matter. So here, T mu nu is going to contain so-called perfect fluids. These are things that just can be described by a pressure and a density. So perfect fluids are described by a pressure and a density. So unfortunately, in 15 minutes, I don't have time to talk all about that. But why don't we pick apart the metric? And I'll show you a little bit about the art of interpreting these space-time metrics. And because this is supposed to be introduction to cosmology, we'll pick FRW. But we could do this with any other one. Okay, so if I had a universe full of radiation, completely homogeneous radiation, so I have some gas of photons with the same density everywhere in space, then Einstein's equations would tell us that the scale factor is T to the 1/2 power. That's the solution to Einstein's equations that I get out. You'll learn how to do that later, but let's just take it for granted that that's what it is. So then that implies that my metric is ds squared equals minus dt squared plus t times dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. So if we were to make a plot, let's draw a space-time diagram. Here we have t, here we have x. And I follow two events. So let's say I pick two events at the same position. Okay. I can ask, what is the proper time between these two events? And that's really easy. So here, there's no difference in x, y, and z. So what is proper time? Okay, so here, my definition of proper time was negative ds squared. So if I just substitute in for this metric, I see that d tau squared is dt squared, and t is just the proper time.
Is that for lambda equals zero?
Yes, this is for lambda equals zero. That's right. So here, I learned that the proper time is just t. Okay, so this coordinate t is just proper time. That's what it means. OK, so another thing we could ask is, OK, well, let's say now I draw another space-time diagram. Here's t, here's x. And I look at a constant time. And let's say I have two events at a constant time. What is the distance between these two events? Okay, so now we've got ds squared, and the t part is 0. And let's say that this is just separated in the x direction, right? So we get that. Okay, so for something that's purely separated in space, I've actually got a few things that I could measure distance, a few ways that I could talk about distance, okay? So there is the there's the coordinate distance. That's just dx, right? So that's what is the distance in these coordinates x that I'm using. And the coordinate distance in x, you can see, well, that doesn't depend on time. So if I were to draw this plot and I have two events, and these events happen on world lines that are just sitting there, you know, let's say I had some sequence of events, for example, then they all occur at the same position, okay, in x, the same coordinate position. There's something else, which is the proper distance. And the proper distance is ds. Okay, so that's like, what is the spatial interval as defined by the metric? And the proper distance, you can see here, goes like t times dx. So in time, the proper distance between two events, if they're traveling on world lines that are following constant position, is actually increasing, right? So as t goes up, the total distance between two events is going to increase. Sorry? Yeah, by the square root of t. Cheers. Okay, so in cosmology, this coordinate distance, this is also called the co-moving distance. Why is it co-moving? Because you can think as space is expanding, stuff is just going with the flow, right? And so the coordinate distance is the proper distance, excuse me, would be increasing with time in that case. Okay. So that's co-moving and proper distance. So what are some other questions we could ask about this space-time? So another thing we could... we could note is this property that I had explained in words about the Big Bang. We could see from the metric what we really mean. So the Big Bang is when t equals 0. So what happens when t equals 0? The scale factor is 0. And what happens when the scale factor is 0? The proper distance between points goes to 0. If I have two points that are separated by a finite distance, the proper distance will be 0 at the Big Bang. But you could see that the coordinate position, or the coordinate separation between different points, coordinate distance, I guess. So that's always finite at the Big Bang. There's different labels on different points. Okay. So even though in terms of the proper distance, any finite separated points are they're really going to be sort of on top of each other. They're also sort of not. So they are distinct. There are distinct points at the Big Bang, and that's why the Big Bang is a time and not a place. Okay, it's a time and not a place because the scale factor just depends on t. If it was a place, there'd be a preferred location. Here, there's no preferred location. It's symmetric in space. So here, this is a better way, I guess, of seeing that the Big Bang is a time, not a place. Another thing to note, if we look at the spatial coordinates in that metric, there's absolutely no reason why they have to stop anywhere. So there's absolutely no problem. In fact, when we write down the FRW universe, we're sort of assuming that the universe is infinite in spatial extent. If I want that not to be true, I have to do something else. So sort of by definition, the maximally symmetric spaces are infinite in extent, in spatial extent. So FRW is usually now I could fix that. So hopefully when you take your relativity course, you will learn that geometry and topology are not necessarily the same thing. So one way to turn my FRW universe with exactly the same metric into a universe that is not in infinite spatial extent is to make a Pac-Man universe, where now I just take space and I start identifying sides, right? So if I go out here, I would come back in here. If I go out here, I would come back in here. So the universe would be a torus. And so in my Pac-Man universe, then FRW would be finite in spatial extent. Okay, but the metric would be the same. I just have different ranges on the coordinates. So even though that's true, sort of without assumptions about topology, FRW is infinite in spatial extent. In fact, it might have a non-trivial topology. And this is something that we go out and measure. So you can pick up a paper from the Planck collaboration that puts constraints on how big the fundamental cell of a Pac-Man universe has to be if we live in one. And we don't think we live in a Pac-Man universe. We think there's no evidence for that. Okay, but it's something we can test. Question? No, it doesn't, because it's identified in a way that doesn't pick a preferred location. So. So another way of drawing this would be as a donut. It's not a very good donut. So if I were to take a sheet of paper and close it, and then if I were to bend the paper and wrap it around, then I would get a torus. And so my Pac-Man universe is really just a torus. And there's no preferred location on the torus.
But if I go diagonally, I have to take a further distance.
Okay, sure. That's right. So that would be a case where your universe was still homogeneous, but not isotropic, and that would break our assumption, right? So that would break our assumption that FRW is really maximally symmetric. Yeah, that's right. And that's also something we test. So we test for isotropy in the universe, and it seems like things are pretty isotropic. Yeah. Okay. Good. So I guess the last thing we can do, and we're running out of time, so this will be the last thing I'll do with this metric, is to ask how light travels. So in order to figure out how light travels in a curved space-time, one thing I could do is I could solve the geodesic equation. A simpler thing to do would be actually just to look at the metric, and we know that for null rays, the space-time interval is zero. So we just set that equal to zero. So if I have a null ray, for example, traveling in the x direction, then this has to be true. And now we can use our sort of cheater abuse of this notation. And we could put this dt squared on one side of this equation. And then we could put the t underneath and take the square root of both sides. And then we could integrate. So if I want to figure out what is the null ray between some point t1 and another point t2 and point x1, x2, so this would be like I have some null ray in t and x between some point t1, x1, and another point t2, x2. I could just evaluate this integral. Okay, so I evaluate this integral, and we would find that, well, I guess I had to put a plus minus somewhere because I took a square root. The plus minus corresponds to the fact that light can go that way, or light can go that way. So it's the direction in x that light's going. So here we're going to get plus or minus. On the right-hand side, we've just got x2 minus x1. And then that is going to equal 2 times t 2 to the 1 half power minus t 1 to the 1 half power. Okay, pretty easy. Okay, so I could solve this now we could make t 2 x 2 is just some arbitrary, you know, if I give you t 1 x 1, where do I end up in t? So we could solve this for t 2, for example. So that would be plus or minus x naught, x1, 2 minus x1, excuse me, over 2 plus t1 to the 1 half power squared. Now we can plot that on our spacetime diagram. So let's plot T2 versus X2. I guess I should have just called them T and X, but that's okay. So here's T1, X1, that point there. And these null rays are going to be parabolas, right? And these parabolas are going to hit 0 at some finite distance. So what we learned from that is, so if I'm sitting here, then there's the furthest distance from me that light can travel, right? So I can receive signals, in principle, only from a finite fixed distance away in this universe. But this universe is probably a lot bigger than that. Why would it be just as big as the part I can see? Probably goes on, well, in principle, it could go on forever. And so there's someone else over here. There's someone else over here. Excuse me for messing up the board. There's someone else over here who sees a different part of the universe that I see. Okay, and that's a feature of Robertson-Walker universes. No one person has causal access at a finite time to everything. So in our universe, there is, we live in an FRW universe. So in principle, we only see a finite fixed portion of the Big Bang. And furthermore, if we go back in time, different parts of the universe are going to see different parts of the Big Bang. So here, let me do a trick. We'll practice my artistic skills just for a second. Creative use of both boards. So there's some time in the future. If we follow this light cone back, it ends up here. And we follow it in this way, it ends up here. Okay? But at some earlier time, if I ask, you know, what does this part of the universe see and what does this part of the universe see, it sees different pieces. Okay? And this is a puzzle, because in our universe, you could think of this as the time at which the CMB was formed, and that as the time we are today. And so different parts of the CMB actually saw different pieces of the Big Bang. But nevertheless, different parts of the CMB have exactly the same temperature to win one part in 100,000. And that is a great mystery. There is no causal reason in an FRW universe why this part of the CMB and this part of the CMB have to have the same temperature. That's called the horizon problem. Okay. And there's this theory called inflation that was invented to solve this problem. And if you could stick it out for another 6 months, you will learn all about inflation's solution to this horizon problem. But I will give you the answer now. The answer is that the Big Bang is not actually the Big Bang. That's not where time began. There is an epoch before. And in that epoch before, I get to extend these light cones back further in time than I thought I could. So that at some point in the past, way down here, they overlap. And so that's how causally these different parts of the CMB could have the same temperature, because in fact, they have a common origin. And that's sort of why the regular FRW piece that we have up there sort of is superseded by this other epoch called inflation. Okay, so that's all the notes I have. I'm happy to hang around and answer any questions or tell you about anything else you want to know about. But that's sort of everything I wanted to say. So any questions about what I showed you, or do you want to ask about something I didn't show you? No? Okay, hungry for lunch then? So with that, I guess I'll see you Monday. And I'll just give a 15-minute spiel on what I do. And then from then forward, it's up to you to come find me if you want to chat. So thanks a lot. Yeah. Cheers.